Visit Save-On Cleaners today.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. If you're listening to the live broadcast, we have lines open for you right now if you'd like to call and be on the program. That would be if you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you have a disagreement with the host. If you'd like to call to disagree and say, you know, I think you got this wrong, feel free to give me a call. You're welcome to do that here. And I'll be glad to talk to you about and let you talk to our audience about whatever it is that's on your mind that way. The number to call if you'd like to be on the program today is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And I just have a couple of announcements, or actually three announcements I want to make about this week, and then we'll go to the phones. One of these announcements is for all of our listeners, and the other is for those who live in the Santa Cruz area. I guess I'll give the second first. But for those of you who live in the Santa Cruz area, or at least driving distance from Santa Cruz, there's a couple of things you may wish to know about. Beginning this Wednesday, and for the next five Wednesdays, I'll be speaking again at Twin Lakes Church the same thing I've been doing on other times. Only this time I'm going to give a five-week series on the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. 5 weeks going through the Sermon on the Mount. Now, that's a rather rapid treatment for me because I usually takes like 14 lectures or something to get through the Sermon on the Mount. But we'll take the most important thoughts from it in 5 weeks. That is every week, every Wednesday in April. There are five Wednesdays in April this year. And so starting this Wednesday and down to the last day of April, there'll be five Wednesdays. I'll be speaking at Twin Lakes Church in Aptos, 6:30. It's open to anybody who wants to come, going through the Sermon on the Mount there for the month of April. The other announcement is that this weekend we have our monthly gathering in Santa Cruz at Mike and Brenda's place. That's going to be April 5th, this Saturday, 7 o'clock. Those of you who know about these meetings and have come, you know where they are, you know what they're about. If you've not come to these meetings before, but you're a listener and would like to meet together with some of our other listeners in the living room and talk about the things of God, about the Scriptures, raise questions, discuss possible answers, it's a great time. We've been doing it for over 3 years now on a monthly basis, once a month in Santa Cruz having these meetings. And if you'd like information about that, you can call Mike or Brenda for directions. It's this Saturday at their house. Their phone number is on our website, but I'll give it to you right now if you want it. It's 831-475-8301. Now, you can get that at the website. I'll give it again, of course, before Saturday. The other thing is for all of our listeners, beginning this Thursday, there will be a series of five consecutive broadcasts. That means it'll be Thursday and Friday this week, and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week, where I'm expecting my guest on the program to be Dr. James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries, a strong Calvinist apologist, and he and I were going to be debating. It was actually planned that we were going to have a debate face-to-face here in Santa Cruz. That got canceled for various reasons, but we are continuing with the plan to dialogue and debate together on the air. I don't think it'll be a formal debate. It'll probably be a lot more like the debate I had with Tim Staples, the Catholic apologist, on the air for 5 days on this program a year and a half ago. Just back and forth, not nitpicking, but dealing with the real issues that divide and provide a basis for the different views of Calvinism and non-Calvinism. I'm not the Calvinist, he is. So that's going to be this Thursday and Friday, and then the next 3 days, beginning of next week, those five consecutive programs going to be with Dr. James White here on The Narrow Path. Okay, and now we'll go to the phones. We still have a line open if you'd like to call the program today. It's 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on the air. Don from Salem, Oregon is our first caller. Hello, Don. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. I have a question on how long did Paul spend in Arabia before he began preaching?
Well, it seems that Paul spent a time of about 14 years between his conversion and the time that he came back to Jerusalem, according to Galatians chapter 1. But we don't know if he was preaching during those years or not. It seems like he was, though. Some people say he was not. Some people say during those years that Paul was in Arabia, I think they picture him kind of just out in the desert, sort of like Elijah the prophet or like John the Baptist out in the desert. The Bible does not say that he was in the desert. The Bible does not say that Paul was, alone. He may well have been doing ministry to populations in various cities in Arabia. And we don't know what he was doing because he only tells us that he was there. He doesn't tell us anything about what he was doing there. But that he probably was doing some preaching while he was there, I would judge from the fact that he began preaching as soon as he got saved in Damascus. When he got saved in Damascus, he began preaching immediately in the synagogue there, enough so that he got in trouble and he had to escape from that town, Damascus, in a basket through a window in the wall, because there were people trying to kill him. So that would be my thought about that. We don't know if there was a period spent not preaching, but the
my problem that I have is that I have been hearing for years that he was in Arabia for 3 years.
Well,
in Galatians, starting
right,
with 17th verse.
Right, between two separate visits to Damascus. Yeah, and is that what you read there?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. But I went immediately into Arabia, later returning to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Peter.
Okay. So you feel like those 3 years were the time he was in Arabia. You could be right.
No.
You could be right.
I think that he spent it mostly in Damascus. He went to Arabia, returned to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I went to Jerusalem.
I see. Yeah, well, see, some scholars...
How did they get this 3 years in Arabia?
Okay. Some scholars believe that Paul spent very little time in Damascus, and when he says, then after 3 years, he means after 3 years after my conversion. Now, if he means 3 years after he had returned to Damascus, as obviously the way the verses standing next to each other could be, then, of course, it would mean that he spent 3 years in Damascus. I think most scholars feel that Paul is telling us a timeline of events from his conversion on, and therefore that 3 years would be after the three years after his conversion. He went to see Peter and so forth. But you could be right. The main thing is, if he went to Damascus and stayed for some unmentioned length of time, and then came to 3 years to Damascus again, that is, I guess, what we'd say is we don't know then how long he would have been saved before he went to Jerusalem. I think the point he's trying to make to the Galatians is how seldom he had contact with the Jerusalem church in the early years of his Christian life. Because I think he's trying to answer the critics who say that he got his gospel at second hand, basically from the other apostles in Jerusalem. So I think what he's saying is, I did not see them much. And in so doing, he's trying to point out how long it was between his opportunities to speak to the people in Jerusalem after his conversion. I think most understand would be saying, after my conversion, it was 3 years before I saw the apostles. And then, in chapter 2, verse 1, after 14 years, which most people think means either after his conversion or after the previous visit to Jerusalem, he says, I went again to Jerusalem, that he seems to be trying to say, I was away for this period. These are the intervals where I was actually away from the apostles and definitely not in a position to get my doctrines from them, because it was 3 years after my conversion. But on the other hand, if he was 3 years in Damascus and an unknown period of time in Arabia, that would mean, of course, that it was more than 3 years total that he was away from Jerusalem. And it seems like he would have given that larger number, since he's trying to establish the fact that he didn't go there very much and that he didn't have much opportunity to see them. So I guess what I'm saying is, he could be saying that he spent 3 years in Damascus. The way it's worded, it does not eliminate that possibility. But if I think scholars base their assumption that the 3 years were largely spent in Arabia and only a little time in Damascus, and he says after 3 years, he means after my conversion. The reason they think that is because if he had spent more time away from Jerusalem than just the 3 years, if, for example, whatever time he spent in Arabia was also, significant, then he would want to give the larger number. He wouldn't want to just tell how long he had been in Damascus the second time. He would want to tell how long he had been away from Jerusalem. And if he was in Damascus alone for 3 years and then some more time in Arabia, he could have given a bigger number of the years that he was away from Jerusalem, I think. And so I think it's that consideration that makes most scholars believe that he's talking about 3 years after his conversion. But the way it's worded in the passage could go the way you're saying.
I think I'm nitpicking.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. It's not, I mean, it may not be the most important thing to resolve. But it's not nitpicking when you hear people say the Bible teaches so-and-so, then you look in the Bible and phew, it looks like it says something else. I think it's very legitimate to raise questions about what you've heard.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, Don. God bless you.
God bless you.
Good talking to you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is going to be Gordon from Portland, Oregon. Gordon, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you, Steve. I have a question that has kind of been an ongoing debate, and it comes from a man by the name of John Anderson, who has written a book called Satan, an Authorized Autobiography. And he was a former psychic and a high priest of a Los Angeles-based occult group in the early 1970s. And when he became converted to Christianity, he came to see that the occult was just smoke and mirrors and nothing behind it. And that in his reading of the Genesis account, he put forth the idea that Adam was the tempter of Eve, that Adam was Satan, and which is very different from the way I've been taught, and that I am blind because I've been taught a lie that's so thoroughly ingrained in me that I can't see the truth. I've listened to your tapes, and if I understand your view, is that Satan is a created being, not a fallen angel, but that he was the tempter, the adversary. Can you throw any light on this for me? And
okay, first of all, I've never read that book, though I think I had heard the title. I think I knew it existed, but I had not read it.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know exactly. If the man is saying that the tempter in the garden was Adam tempting Eve, then that raises several difficulties that are unnecessary to raise. I mean, you don't have to suggest that Adam was the tempter, and if you do, you present difficulties that you don't have otherwise. One is that you have to suggest that Adam was the serpent, because in the Garden of Eden, it's very clearly the serpent that beguiled Eve. It says that in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, I think it's around verse 3. Paul says, I'm worried that, as the serpent beguiled Eve, so your hearts might also be corrupted from the simplicity in Christ. So Paul indicated that the serpent beguiled Eve. That's certainly what we get from reading Genesis 3. And yet Adam is treated in the story as if he's a third individual, because it says that she saw these things about the fruit, she took it, she ate it, and she gave it to her husband with her in the garden, and he ate it. So we find her, in a sense, tempting Adam, not vice versa. And she was tempted prior to that by the serpent. And, you know, to identify Adam with the serpent would be very unnatural, it seems to me. It also raises another serious problem. That is that if Adam was tempting Eve, then he must have sinned at some prior time. In order to try to drive her away from God, he would already be in sin. And if that were true, then his sin had happened earlier without being recorded. And it would seem very strange to suggest that Adam had, that the first sin was actually committed by Adam, not Eve, and that it's not recorded even what it was. You know, there's no story about his fall, only about Eve. So I think the way Genesis reads most naturally is that the serpent, you know, he deceived Eve, and so she ate, and then she induced her husband to eat. That's how it's worded. So I think the book, I don't know what he uses for arguments there, but it doesn't sound like it has the Bible on its side.
I think it hinges around the idea that Satan is not a fallen angel, but he was an adversary, and that somehow, unwittingly, Adam was the adversary, and merely thinking the thought or making the suggestion to eat of the tree was not
a sin on Adam's part.
Yeah, that's all I can put together, but I'm certainly not comfortable with that.
Right. Well, the truth is that the name Satan does mean adversary, and it is the ordinary Hebrew word for adversary, so that there are times in the Hebrew Old Testament where the word the Satan or Satan simply is referring to an adversary, not always the same adversary that we call the devil. Though in the New Testament, the Hebrew word Satan is brought into the Greek New Testament unchanged and untranslated and used as a proper name for the devil. So, in other words, when you find the word Satan in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, it's just another Hebrew word among all the Hebrew words, and it just means adversary. But when you bring the word Satan into the New Testament, well, the New Testament isn't written in Hebrew, and yet Satan is still a Hebrew word. So in speaking of the devil as Satan in the Greek New Testament, they have chosen, of course, to use Satan as a proper name, not as if they were just treating the word Satan as the word adversary, they would have used the Greek word for adversary. So anyway, I disagree. First of all, Satan is not mentioned by name in Genesis chapter 3 at all. There's no mention of Satan there. There's only three times in the Old Testament, or three situations in which Satan is mentioned by name in the Old Testament. One is where he induced David to number the people in Chronicles. One is in Zechariah chapter 3, where he is accusing Joshua the high priest. And the other is, of course, in the first two chapters of Job, where he is accusing Job. Those are the only times in the Old Testament that Satan, the devil, is mentioned by name, by the name Satan. But in the Garden of Eden story, there's no reference to Satan by name. It just refers to the serpent and describes the serpent as if the serpent is one of the animals. You know, the serpent was the most clever of the beasts of the field that God had made, it says. So we don't learn even that the serpent in Genesis 3, we don't learn that that's Satan until you get to the book of Revelation, where it says in Revelation 12:9 that he is that old serpent, the devil, and called Satan. So it's interesting. In the Old Testament, we don't even learn that Satan was in the Garden of Eden, but we do learn that from later references in the New Testament.
That's a good point. Okay, Steve, well, thank you very much for the time you spent working me through this issue.
Well, it's not worked through altogether because there's still some unanswerable questions about Satan's original condition. He may be a fallen angel, or he may have been created to be an adversary and a tester, but those things are not stated with enough clarity for us to be dogmatic about them in Scripture.
No, that I understand, but I was really struggling a bit with a sound defense to separate Adam from being Satan.
Yeah, I guess there's no reason in the passage to identify the two.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much, Steve.
Okay, Gordon, thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye-bye. All right, our next caller is Jeremiah from Portland, Oregon. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have a line open for you at 1-800-438-4783. 1-800-530-5090. If you have a question about the Bible or if you disagree with the host on some point and would like to balance comment, feel free to call me right now. My name is Steve Gregg. The program's called The Narrow Path. The phone number, 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Jeremiah, thanks for calling. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, good to talk to you too, Steve. Hey, I have some questions in 1st and 2nd Timothy. There seems to be kind of a theme about sound doctrine and then to abide in it or to teach it. And then when it talks about unsound doctrine or myths or stuff that's irreverent, it seems to say, you know, have nothing to do with, to avoid it, and be careful not to wander into it and to stay away from it. And so what do you think that would correlate to, today? Are there certain things that we should abstain from? Like, I don't think, like, they would get together in the New Testament and read the Gnostic Gospels and see what they can glean from them and try to develop discernment from. There's certain things that it seems like we shouldn't even have anything to do with, you know? And so would that correlate today to anything out there, other false teachings, in that same way? Or would that just be people trying to be the thought police if they would say the same thing regarding
right.
certain subjects today?
Yeah. Well, I think we still need to warn against false doctrine and encourage sound doctrine. At the same time, we need to know what doctrines are, you know, Paul has in mind. And the word doctrine, we know, just means teaching. We usually reserve the word doctrine in our modern usage. We usually refer it to theological doctrines, theological concepts. So we've got, you know, when we think of doctrine, we might be thinking of the doctrine of the Trinity or the doctrine of sola scriptura or the doctrine of justification by faith alone or the doctrine of hell or something like that. These are doctrines, but those are, of course, more doctrines along the lines of theological concepts or theological truths. Whereas we have to remember that a major part of the teaching in the early church was teachings not about just theological truths, but about how to live your life. Jesus, for example, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, especially, almost all of his teachings are teachings about how to live. And when he gave the Great Commission in Matthew 28, he said, "Go and disciple the nations, teaching them to observe everything I've commanded you." So, in other words, the emphasis on teaching in Jesus' ministry and to his disciples, and then when he says to them to disciple others, is to teach people to obey his commands. In other words, to live a certain way that Jesus taught us to live. Now, I'm not saying there aren't theological truths that have to be taught as well, but I do think that when Paul talks about sound doctrine, a lot of times his emphasis is on the teachings about how to live. That's the doctrines that are sound. And a good example of that would be in Titus chapter 2, where in verse 1, Paul begins by saying, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. And then he goes on to give examples of what he means by sound doctrine. He says that older men should be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. Older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. That they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, and incorruptibility. Now, he starts out by saying you need to speak the things that constitute sound doctrine. And he says, for example, that older men should be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, and love, and patience. That older women should be reverent and not slanderers, and that they should teach good things to younger women. Namely, that the younger women should be lovers of their husbands and lovers of their children, keepers at home and chaste, and etc. and that young men should be sober-minded. Now, he says, and show yourself to be a good example of this sound doctrine, too. Obviously, the sound doctrine he's talking about there is moral living or distinctively Christian living. That's and I think that much of the false doctrine that that Paul was concerned with when he wrote the epistles was also false teachings about how to live. I mean, remember that Jude said that he found it necessary to contend for the faith once delivered because false teachers had come in, teaching people, that turning the grace of God into license. In other words, teaching that people could do what they want to do, even sinfully, because the grace of God would permit that. And I think that was a problem in the early church. The Gnostic heresy basically gave permission to sin. And and that's what made Gnosticism, I mean, that's only, that's one of the things that made Gnosticism so dangerous. Of course, Gnosticism also taught wrong theological concepts about Jesus and about God and so forth. And they were nasty concepts. I mean, the Gnostics taught that, that Jesus' father did not create the universe and that Jesus' father was not the God of the Old Testament. They taught that that was a different God, actually the devil, the demiurge, as they called him, and that the God who made the world and that was the God of Moses and so forth was the demiurge, this devil creature, and that Jesus came to reveal the true God, who is his father, who is a different God than that. I mean, that's obviously horrible theology because, you know, of course, that makes Jesus something other than the son of the creator God. And so it misunderstands who Jesus is altogether. But one of the biggest problems with Gnosticism is it gave people permission to sin. And I think the moral life of the church was as important as the theological life of the church in the early church. And I think that when Paul talks about sound doctrine, he's mostly talking about, he talks an awful lot about moral living and avoiding fornication and those kinds of things, which the false doctrines permitted people to do. But in terms of theological concepts, of course, we need to have the right theology because ideas have consequences. If we believe that Jesus' father is not the creator of the world and not the God of the Old Testament, well, that, of course, totally puts Jesus at variance with the Old Testament, revelation. And it makes, you know, it just brings stupid, unnecessary confusion. So I believe we need to have correct theology as much as we can.
Yeah.
And correct living. I do think, though, that we need to be much more exacting in the details of godly living in our lives than exacting in the details of correct theology on every little thing. Because, obviously, we need to have the right God we're worshiping. We need to have the right Jesus. We need to know why Jesus came. And we need to be recognizing that he died and rose again. He's our Lord. And that we're his followers. Without these understandings, we can't be Christians at all, I think. But beyond this, we might have any number of doctrines about the end times different from one another's doctrines. Or about something like Calvinism and Arminianism or a lot of different things. Different views of hell. Christians have different doctrines on a lot of different things that do not make them dangerous. I think the basics of sound doctrine would primarily be the doctrines about who God is and who Jesus is and what he has done. But then that'd be the theological aspects. But then, of course, the more important thing is how are we living our lives? Are we living in obedience to Jesus? And, you know, what we are supposed to primarily teach is teach people to observe what Jesus commanded.
Okay. What I see commanded in Timothy, that when it says to abstain from or have nothing to do with or to avoid, it kind of repeats itself in saying that, and it talks about irreverent, silly myths, and talks about avoid the irreverent babble and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge, have nothing to do with foolish, ignorant controversies that breed quarrels. Avoid irreverent babble, for it will lead people into more ungodliness. And so, do you think that those would strike probably both aspects of doctrine, both in godly living and in you know, theological concepts?
Well, we definitely find both concerns there.
Yeah.
Because he feels that if you have the false doctrines, the false
theology,
it will lead to ungodliness. Right. If a person adopts Gnostic ideas, they will, of course, live an immoral life. Yeah.
But it seems a kind of heavy, I think, today in our, even amongst the churches, this where authority has been abused so much, that if anyone were to come out today and to say, you know, avoid this, have nothing to do with it, I think there'd be a reaction like, you know, how dare you say that? We can all read and understand and discern ourselves, you know, where there's clearly some things that aren't profitable to even deal with.
Yeah, but see, different churches will have their own subjective ideas, if we're talking about theology, about what those things are. For example, a denomination that I used to associate with considers that sound doctrine means dispensational eschatology.
Yeah.
And so if you are part of their church and you believe and teach something other than, say, a pre-tribulation rapture or something like that, well, then they consider you are in violation of what they call sound doctrine. And and therefore, they feel like you should go somewhere else because you're bringing unsound doctrine into their church. Now, to my mind, if consider any doctrinal controversy you wish.
Uh-huh.
If a person could hold to the wrong side of that controversy and still be as good a Christian as if they held the other view, then that controversy must not be a necessary controversy. I mean, it seems to me. If a person could be as good a Christian as if they believed in Calvinism, as they would be if they believed in Arminianism, then it must not be essential for a person to be of one or the other view. It's preferable for people to be of the right view rather than the wrong view, but in terms of essential to sound doctrine, essential to orthodoxy, I don't think that we can include among those doctrines that would make people heretics. I don't think we can include those things where good Christians can hold these opposite views. Now, if you meet somebody who says, I don't believe that the Father of Jesus Christ created the world, but I think the devil did, then I believe you've got such a heresy there that you have a different God, a different Jesus, a different Bible, a different everything. You're not, you know, there's nothing left in your theology to make you a Christian.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but it seems even on the secondary issues, what Paul's getting at is there's things that just breed quarrels, and the secondary issues sometimes seem to breed more quarrels, you know?
Well, I agree. And I think that is a situation that I think we have to endure that situation more in our day than was necessary to do in Paul's day. And the reason for that is that, let's say somebody held the wrong view on eschatology in Paul's day. Well, they could ask Paul what his view was.
Yeah,
and he could clarify it. And then anybody who accepted the apostolic authority would agree with what Paul said. Anyone who disagreed would be in rebellion against the apostolic authority because Paul had clarified and answered their question, and they knew exactly what he meant, because he told them, and they'd inquired, and therefore, anyone who disagreed with that was simply putting himself against the apostles. That's not the way it is now that Paul's not here, because there can be two people on opposite sides of some issues who both believe that Paul taught what they are saying, you know, and therefore neither party is trying to cause divisions. Neither party is challenging the apostolic authority. Neither party is trying to break off, a divisive branch from the main body. Both parties are trying to faithfully represent what they understand Paul to teach, and he's not here to ask them if they're getting it right. So, in a sense, people today could be wrong without being wrong-hearted. But they could not be wrong without being wrong-hearted back when the apostles were there to clarify things.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it just goes to show that just the wisdom and grace that it takes to have the difference between healthy debate with brothers and sisters in Christ versus fighting and quarreling.
Well, right. See, here's the thing. If two people are Christians and hold different views, and they can talk about their differences, even vociferously arguing for each of their respective positions, but they still completely love each other, respect each other, and do not really require the other to agree with them, then to me there's nothing unhealthy in that kind of exchange. What's unhealthy is when one of those parties says, if you can't come around to my way of seeing it, you're stupid and you're not a good Christian. Well, then there's, to my mind, that the person who's saying that is divisive.
Yeah, and then they cut off fellowship from one another and leave churches or don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, Jeremiah, I need to take another call, but I hope we covered your subject reasonably well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, Steve. It's been a while, and God bless you, man.
It's always good talking to you.
Okay, you
too. God bless you, too. Bye now. All right, we have a line open for you now at 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can call with a question about the Bible or with a point of dispute with the host, if you wish. At 1-800-438-5090. Barbara from Jefferson, Oregon is next. Barbara, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Do I need to turn my radio down?
If you can hear your radio, then you need to turn it down.
Okay, anyway, I called you last week, and I had a two-part question. You said you did answer the first one, which was I was wondering why the churches didn't come out for peace and in opposition to the wars and the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And the second part of my question was how do Christians justify killing as in shock and awe and all the killing that takes place with the bombings? I mean, I don't understand that.
That's a good question. And I'll say this, that many Christians do not. There are many Christians who think that bombing is wrong. Many Christians think all war is evil, and that Christians should have no involvement in it. There are some who believe, primarily those who believe in the just war theory, that any war that is justifiable can only be justified if non-combatants are immune from harm. So, in other words, bombing a city where even one civilian would be killed would not be agreeable with the just war theory.
Uh-huh.
And so there are many Christians who hold that view. Now, you apparently are thinking primarily of the Republican, conservative evangelicals of America who seem to, in many cases, just go along with whatever George Bush does, and they don't seem particularly critical of any of the things we're doing in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere. I'm not sure how they justify that, but I do think what they justify it by is the assumption that if we were not doing those things, that evil would triumph, and that killing certain people is an unfortunate price that has to be paid for a greater good. And that greater good, they think, is democracy and peace in the Middle East, and perhaps cheaper oil prices. I'm not sure. But the point is that I think that's how many Christians do think about it. They think that, well, you know, it's sad that, you know, sometimes a few civilians get killed in our attacks, but hey, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and what we're trying to do over there is, establish a different political order in Iraq, and so I think that's how they justify it.
It seems like they would accept one part of the Bible just blow past the parts that works for them to get cheap oil or whatever that is. But I do wonder, and it just breaks my heart that we're doing what we're doing. And I pray and I cry myself to sleep every night for the children that are so by all of this. And I just don't understand why the churches don't come out against it.
Yeah, well, you have to remember that, you know, we are supposed to love our we Christians are supposed to love our enemies and do good to those who persecute us and so forth, which makes it hard for us to ever think it's right to fight in war at all. Even the people who are shooting at us, one could argue, if we were complete like Jesus, we just go ahead and let them shoot us. Jesus didn't defend himself and didn't allow his disciples to defend him when he was facing mortal danger from armed people. And some people say to be like Jesus, we should just be like, Gandhi. Of course, Gandhi was not a Christian, but, you know, total, you know, pacifist and so forth. Others feel that is that morality, that Christian morality is much more nuanced than that. And that it would be wonderful if we lived in a world where nobody got hurt and justice prevailed. But that they would say we live in a world where there's great evil, and there's a sense in which Christians need to be involved in promoting justice. And where there is great evil, they would say, perfect justice cannot be promoted without, removing those causes of evil. It's like removing cancer from a body to make it healthy. That to remove the wicked is one way of promoting a more just society in the future. And really the difference between these two views is a difference that has existed among Christians for a very long time, probably from the time of Constantine on. Some Christians are seeing the task of the church as simply to be faithful to Jesus, to live a pure life, to be an alternative society, and to really allow God to judge what non-Christians do, and for the church to simply be like Jesus. That's one group. And then the other group would say, no, the church is here to transform society, to transform secular society, so that even those who do not become Christians live in a more just and a more humane world. And so it comes down to different interpretations of what Jesus meant when he said, you are the salt of the earth and you're the light of the world. Does that mean that we are supposed to bring about a better circumstance in the world generally, in which case we're going to have to, you know, get our hands dirty, you know, in politics and war and things like that? Or does it simply mean that we are to live in a sense, a separated alternative lifestyle and let the world see it and let the world decide if they want to follow it or not?
Wouldn't it depend on wicked or evil? Wouldn't that depend on who's on the receiving end of the bomb? And why would we think to go and kill people? We can make the world a better place. I don't understand that kind of thinking, and it certainly is not the way Christ would lead us to believe.
Yeah, see, that is what different Christians would dispute. I think more like you do about this, but it's, you know, there certainly are a lot of Christians who are thinking along the lines of St. Augustine. They're thinking along the lines of of Thomas Aquinas, some Christian philosophers of the ancient past who formulated philosophy of the church actually being an instrument for changing the world politically and having to use political and military means to do it at times. Whereas before Augustine, the church fathers, at least, were against Christians fighting in the military. They were against Christians even being in the police force. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that, but I'm just saying that's what they said. That's what they believed. The early Christians, for the first three centuries, believed that government business was not the church's business.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've had both views side by side for a very long time.
Well, I really appreciate your thoroughness in your answer, and I am really happy that you feel the way I do about it. So I'll just wish you a good day, and thank you so much for your time you've given me today, okay?
Now, before you're gone, Barbara, apparently another caller has called while I've been talking to you.
Uh-huh.
And I think would like to get in touch with you. I'm not sure exactly how to do that. Oh, I think she'd like... okay, if you want this other caller to contact you, it's a lady who wants to talk to you, I think, about this subject. I'm going to put you on hold, and you can tell my call screener if you wish to give your number or not. If you don't want to, that's fine.
Okay.
If you want to, you can give your number, and then my call screener will give your number to this other caller.
Wonderful. Okay. I would be in agreement with that.
Okay, Barbara. God bless you. I'm going to put you on hold, and thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, David, if you want to just get her number and give it to that other caller, that's fine. Yeah, we don't usually pass our listeners' phone numbers around to, but if you want to do it in a private way like that, I suppose there's nothing lost in doing that. Well, we'll go next online and talk to Karen from Portland, Oregon. And Karen, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, I was just calling with a little comment, just listening over a period of time. There's several people, even at my church, some older sisters, some people, they get upset about, really upset about wars and all this kind of stuff on television, and me not being a television watcher, I can tell it's coming from the television, if you know what I mean? I'm wondering if maybe a lot of Christians might rethink that they're getting a lot of this stuff from television and mass media. And without television and mass media, it's pretty calm out there, you know, on our American soil. And there's things like public schools to be involved in, maybe hospitals, maybe the food banks.
Karen, I think some people would say, well, okay, if we don't listen to the television and the news, you're right, it's pretty calm in my neighborhood. But am I not then being like an ostrich, sticking my head in the sand, saying, you know, as long as I don't see any evil, I'm not disturbed? I think some people would say we need to know what's going on in other places and not just be aware of how peaceful it is in our town. I would hope they would think, in order that we can do something about it, at least to pray about it. Now, obviously, through most of history, we didn't have television. We didn't have radio, and therefore people did have to just live with either knowledge of what was going on in their neighborhood or rumors, you know, rumors that came to them, wars and rumors of wars, you know. But we have more than rumors now. We can actually watch the war taking place on our TV screen, and I'm not saying we have an obligation to watch it. As a matter of fact, I don't. I don't have a TV. I've never actually had a television in my home, and I don't know what's on the news there, but I do listen to the radio news from time to time because I think it is kind of important to have some idea of what's going on in the world.
I'm not very informed.
I'm not very informed about the war and so forth, and I think that might frustrate some of my listeners for whom it's a bigger issue. But I do think I should know something about it. You just have to apportion your time to know about the things that you have to know about more than others.
Well, I get it from talking with people on the street, or I hear it maybe at church, or, you know, these kind of things. Or the ones that are becoming ineffective and the ones upset about these things coming from the television and the media seem to be maybe the older sisters. And I'm wondering if maybe they aren't maybe more effective, maybe letting the elders listen to these items, and maybe there's many items local that we can be involved in without, you know, having nightmares all night, what we just saw on the television, which I don't watch either. I just noticed this.
I don't know much about the people you're talking about and how this information is affecting them. I think I would put it this way. Of course, ignorance is bliss. But it's not necessarily the case that God calls us to have a blissful life of ignorance. In many cases, we are called to struggle against principalities and powers and rules of the darkness of this age. We're actually called to a warfare. Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2, endure hardship like a good soldier of Jesus Christ. We're supposed to be a little tougher than that. I mean, it's horrible when we hear about atrocities, and especially if there's nothing we can do about them. Or they're just, for example, a past atrocity. If someone wants to give me a news story about a woman who drowned her children in a bathtub, I don't need to know about that. For one thing, I can't do anything about it. It's already a done deal. She's probably not going to drown any more children in her bathtub. And so I don't, you know, maybe I need to pray for her family or something. But there's a lot of times when news is not of value. It is simply sensational because for the sake of ratings. But there are times when news definitely is about ongoing crises about which I should be praying. Maybe in some cases I may be supposed to speak out against them or something. And if that's the case, I would have to know about them somehow. I don't have to watch TV, though. I mean, I'd rather listen to the radio, and I can get a digest of the news pretty quickly that way usually. But some people want to involve themselves a lot more in these things. Now, you talk about the women in your church are negatively affected or having nightmares. I don't think Christians should have to have nightmares, although, of course, sometimes real life is kind of nightmarish, and certainly for the people in Iraq who are experiencing these things, they don't have the luxury of not having nightmares about it. I think that what we need to be is capable of knowing what's going on and still trusting God and not being fearful, and also being proactive, trying to figure out, well, what would God have me do in such a horrible world as this to alleviate the suffering of people over there. For me to just stay home and have nightmares about it isn't going to help anything, but at the same time, if I'm not fearful, if I'm trusting God and I'm not fearful, then I'm not going to be having nightmares anyway about it.
Well, I get enough from reading scripture, you know, death, war, all the wars through the Old Testament, things like that, to warn me and keep me awake to the things at hand. I was just concerned about maybe calming the, calming people down by suggesting maybe less TV. And they might.
Well, I think less TV would be good for everybody. I think less TV would be good for everybody, though I don't know if less. I don't know that everybody should be. Like I said, I don't think everyone should be like an ostrich with their head in the sand. I do think that there are some people who have need to know more than others about these things. For example, you know, if I pray every day for God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven, God knows what has to be done, and God knows there's a war over there, and it's possible that that may be all I need to know. And especially since most Christians throughout history, if we lived before the invention of the television and the radio, we would simply be ignorant of it anyway. I mean, we might know that some of our neighbors were sent off to war somewhere in Iraq, but we might have very little information as to what's going over there, and we would still be expected to live good Christian lives and even intercede for the world. But I think there are people whose calling requires that they know a lot more, and there are people who are just curious, and their curiosity may not be really good.
Okay, well, happy peace.
Same to you. Thanks, Karen, for your call.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye now. All right. Well, we're just about out of time here. I can say you've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and if you'd like to help us stay on the air, I'll tell you a little something about that. We pay the radio stations for the time we use on the air. And you may have noticed, if you've been listening the past hour, we don't have any commercial breaks. We don't have any sponsors. We don't sell anything. Sometimes I even forget to mention our website, which I should not forget. People tell me I need to mention it more because there's a lot of resources at our website, but they're all free. And if you go to our website and avail yourself of those three things, you will not be contacted by us at all. That is, we don't ask you to give your email address. When you go to our email, you just download stuff and take it away, and we don't even know you were there. The reason I say that is someone was telling me the other day that they had been to the website of some prominent ministry that's on the radio, and they had, ever since they'd gone to the website, they've been getting junk emails from this ministry. I know that a lot of ministries send junk mail, too, a lot. Some people say that they hear from certain ministries two or three times a month with junk mail. We don't do that. I'm not trying to be more righteous than others. We just don't have the time or the inclination or the thought that that's useful. If you write to us and send a donation, you'll hear from us exactly four times a year. We send out a receipt quarterly to those who we don't even send it out monthly. And apart from that receipt, you'll never hear from us. We don't send out emails. So you'll retain your privacy. Go to our website, see what's there, take what you want, and you'll never hear from us about it. You write to us, you might hear back from us. But if you don't, you won't. So we don't want to intrude in your life. We just want to give to you. We pay for the time on the radio from listener contributions, and we do need those. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 1-800-273-9503. The website that I mentioned is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's The Narrow Path, just like the name of the program, .com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining.